Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, August 28th, 2012, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Our featured guest this evening is author Nick Redfern, who has written over 20 books on many paranormal subjects. His newest book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, will be our main topic of discussion tonight, and we'll hear about governmental involvement with the Dead Sea Scrolls, Noah's Ark, the Pyramids, contactee George Van Tassel, whom you've heard Lavendar speak about, Edgar Cayce, and many more fascinating correlations that Mr. Redfern has written about. He's appeared on more than 70 TV shows, including Ancient Aliens, UFO Hunters, and shows on the History Channel, National Geographic, Sci-Fi, MSNBC, Fox News, and the BBC. You can follow his blog at Nick Redfern, and I'm going to spell this all for you. That's NICKREDFERNFORTEAN.blogspot.com. And that is on our show page in case you didn't get a chance to write all that down. At the top of the show, we'll have our Starseed News segment with Anastasia bringing current events of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails sent to us from around the globe. We want to thank Chris for hosting the switchboard this evening, and we invite you to call in with questions or comments tonight, and that number is 917-889-8292. And remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. If you like our show, we encourage you to click follow on our show page. You'll get our show notices, and it will help promote our show and guests. And then do remember to tell a few friends about us. For our new listeners, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. We'd also like to thank Rose, Anastasia, and Sahar for their continuing great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. And we'll get started in just a moment, but first I want to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. Our Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings in your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. If you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. Please allow 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you do get it in time. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Hello, ladies. How are you this evening?
Lavendar here. I'm doing really good. I can't wait to hear what Anastasia is going to bring forth tonight because I know it's going to be exciting. And, of course, Nick is going to be just a wowie-zowie guest for us. So, Anastasia, take it away.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. Yes. Great to be with you. And it's been an exciting week, and I am right there with Lavendar. I'm really looking forward to tonight's show. So let's start out the new segment by talking about a couple of cool things with the space. So, you know, I always like to start out with that. So we have something going on in the sky called moon dogs, and the moon is waxing full this week, and it's a good time to look out for moon dogs. Now, moon dogs appear 23 degrees from the moon, and it's splashes of light shining with the colors of a rainbow, but they're not rainbows, of course. And unlike rainbows, they're caused by raindrops. And, rainbows are caused by raindrops, but moon dogs are caused by ice crystals. So there, I got that out. So during the summer, when the clouds are high and cold enough for water to start to freeze, We can watch for moon dogs, and that's essentially that's halos around the moon. I'm sure we've all seen those and are familiar with them, but they're a lot of fun to look for.
Well, that's fascinating. Anastasia, are you saying dogs like
D-O-G.
Ruff, ruff?
Yeah, like ruff ruff moon dogs.
I never heard of. I mean, everyone, I'm sure, like you said, has seen the halo around the moon, but I never knew what caused it.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Okay,
yeah.
Continue.
Well, that's fun to look for. And the sky has just been so exquisitely beautiful this year. And I just hope everybody's getting a chance to look up and appreciate the stars and what's out there. And, you know, we get so focused. Of course, our starseed are very focused on things from the heavens. But in general, it's just good to take time every evening to look out. You can see some wonderful UFO sightings doing that, too. So all you guys remember to look up because there's really cool things happening out there. A lot of fireballs going on, by the way, everybody. That is still continuing all over the world. Which I do believe is not just connected to the persides that we've had or anything like that. I mean, these are something that appears to be quite separate. And I'm going to do a special program, I think, on fireballs themselves. But keep an eye out. Look out for that because there's just all they're just happening everywhere. All over the world. And the sun is quiet right now, so that's kind of nice. It's been very active over the last couple of months, but it's quiet at this point in time. And one last thing about the solar system, and that is that amateur astronomers have been monitoring a big cloud of plasma that is hovering above the sun's eastern horizon. Now, it's a really, really big thing. The sun is just huge. They figure that it's about, let's see, what I'm looking at my article here now to see if they can tell us how long it is. I have a photo of it, so I'm at an advantage to see. Let's see if I can find a size for you. Well, no.
It's huge.
It's huge. Yes, it's absolutely enormous. Okay.
Triple
if you
huge.
Want to check that out, go to spaceweather.com. They've got a great picture of that on there. But lots of interesting things happening relative to the sun this year. Okay, so we'll go on now to some emails. I got a wonderful email about some orbs. You all just sent me wonderful photographs of orbs. I am telling you, I thought I had seen orbs until I started getting starseed photos of orbs. Now, starseed seem to have the ones that get these orb photos are really taking exceptional pictures, and I really think it's an exceptional contact that certain ones of you really have. Now, this email is from Danielle, and she gave me permission, so I'd just like to read it to you. She said, I was listening to the show from the other night, and I decided I should send you some of my orb pics. And she said, I'm including a picture from Gettysburg and other pictures that showed orbs. She said, but this was the most impressive. It was a cloudy day, but what showed on the picture was certainly not a cloud. She's explaining this to me. And, of course, I'm at an advantage again because I can see the photos, but I got to tell you something. They are awesome. And she took pictures also where she and a group were around a medicine wheel in Sedona. And my goodness, the orbs are, it's dazzling, you guys. And these are, some of them are hexagonal. They have rainbows in the middle. There's one huge orange orb in the photograph that is, I mean, these are phenomenal photographs. So I want to thank Danielle very much for sharing that with us, and as well as the others that have sent orb photos. It's just great. These are beautiful. I think we ought to do a scrapbook maybe in a collection of paranormal photos by Starseed. What do you all think about that? Wouldn't that be fun?
Well, absolutely. We can put it on the forum. We can put it on the website.
Yeah. When you all email me with these photographs, and those of you that have already sent me photos, if you wouldn't mind, if you're interested and would like to put these up on the forum, maybe we could do a special page, and others of you that have paranormal photos you want to send, please just jot me off an email and tell me it's okay that I have your permission to use those photographs, perhaps with your name or if you want to use a pseudonym, fine, whatever. But I think we should start putting these all together and compile a scrapbook. I think that would be wonderful. Okay.
Right, as well as the location.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes,
uh-huh.
Yes, please. Location, date, whatever. Yeah, that can help us see where these are occurring. I want to thank all of our Starseed that sent me emails this last week. You've all been wonderful, and I just don't have time to mention all of you today, but you know who you are, and I love you. And I do want to say real quick that some of you have phoned me. You need to get connected with me for appointments or whatever. I'm running behind. Please bear with me till I get back with you. It's just starting to get backlogged, and I'll get to you as soon as I can. And please don't feel ignored because you aren't. All right. Well, I have something that I want to bring to your attention that's really pretty cool. This was shown to me by Lavendar. She asked that I bring it up tonight. And it is from the website. Hold on a second, everybody. Hold on. Well, you know, dead air in radio is not a good thing.
Well, just tell us what it is, and then we'll catch up with the name later.
Okay. Well, this documentary filmmaker wants to make a film, and he's requesting donations. And it's about the Valiant Thor incident. And I'm just going to read to you what he says on his website. And Lavendar, if you want to interject anything, please do, okay? He wants to make a documentary of true events about the space emissary Valiant Thor, who lived at the Pentagon for 3 years under the Eisenhower administration. And he says, and I'm quoting this from his website, he says, the landing of Valiant Thor was perhaps the first documented landing of a human-type alien by military officials. He met with President Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon for an hour, and then the alien was put on VIP status and shuttled back to the Pentagon. Now, this is a quote from Harley Bird, who wrote Project Blue Book. Anyway, Dr. Frank Strangis met with Commander Valiant Thor, who calls himself a created being and spiritual representative of the universe, and they met together on Christmas Eve in 1959. And this is about when Thor landed on Earth in his technological wonder called Victor 1, which occurred in 1957 at 8 o'clock in the morning. And he was met again by President Eisenhower, Vice President Richard Nixon, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Everyone went to the Oval Office to meet with this extraterrestrial. And this film that he wants to make, that he's requesting help with, is all about this incident. He's wanting to do a documentary of it. And that is at Stranger... hold on a second here, and I'll tell you. Just a second. Kickstarter.com. So if you go to Kickstarter.com, and you type in Stranger at the Pentagon, you can find out more about that. And if you're interested, maybe you could make some donations to this filmmaking project that he's going through. Okay? So, anyway, there's more to read on that. It's very interesting, and he has a little short video on there for you to watch about it. All right, well, I want you to know there's been some sightings of UFOs in Indiana recently, just the last week. Some of them were caught on video during thunderstorm. So any of you in Indiana that have had sightings, I need to hear from you. Also, southern Missouri, I need to hear what's going on there, if we've had any more sightings there. I know some of you promised to be on lookout for me. So we want to watch Indiana and Missouri. Those seem to be the hot spots at the moment. All right, we're just about done here, but I want to tell you something that's real fascinating, everybody. A local British politician named Simon Parks has gone public about his lifelong alien abduction experiences. He's gone public. He is with the Labour Party, and he stunned the town council by claiming his real mother is a 9-foot green alien with 8 fingers. This is what he says. Councillor Simon Parks, who was elected to represent certain populace there in his town, certain ward or group of people, said that although he has had hundreds of close encounters with extraterrestrials, it won't interfere with his mission to help residents in his political position. He has a YouTube video out, and he said that he first saw an alien at the age of eight months, when a traditional kite-shaped face with huge eyes, tiny nostrils, and a thin mouth appeared over his crib. He said two green stick figures came in, and I was aware of someone's movement over my head. I thought, these are not my mummy's hands. Mummy's hands are pink. So he goes on to tell his story. But he claims that the person that came to him as a child sent him a telepathic message and said, I am your real mother. I'm your more important mother. And he has a sketchbook of these aliens, and they look typically in the shape and figure of what we consider to be grays. They look very similar, but they're colored in green, and they're very, very tall. And he claims that as an 11-year-old, he was taken by a craft, on board a craft by his alien mother, and he got to meet all of his family on board. And he said, the reason extraterrestrials are interested in me is not because of my physical body, but because of what is inside of me. They're interested in my soul. And people in the UK are having a hard time accepting this, But what he has to say to that is, it's a personal matter and it doesn't affect my work. He said, I'm more interested in fulfilling my political responsibilities, and I'll see that I do that, and I accept that people don't want to talk to me about aliens, but he said, it's the truth, and that's the story of my life. So, isn't that interesting? Somebody in a political position coming out and telling that and sharing that with the world. I just think that's fascinating.
Well, I hope that's the beginning of a trend.
Well,
honesty in politics, I mean, what a novel idea.
Absolutely. That's why I brought it up tonight. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So the guy has some courage.
Yes.
So anyway, I guess that's about it for tonight. I'm going to turn it over to you, Ariel, and our wonderful guest in Lavendar, and just sit back and listen.
Okay. Well, Anastasia, we'll talk to you again, I'm sure, at the end of the program. So, Lavendar, would you please introduce our guest?
Okay. So, Nick, well, you have the bio on him. I don't have the bio.
Well, that's, I mean, I read that
already?
At the beginning. Yeah, I did that at the beginning of the show. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado.
Yeah, Mr. here we go. Nick,
Mr.
are you
Nick
there?
Mr. Nick Redfern, you are on the air. Welcome, Nick.
No, well, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here with us.
Sure.
And I know that there's some areas where you and Lavendar have overlapped in your writings and her experiences. So, Lavendar, where do you want to start?
Well, first I want to talk about this new book that you have called The Pyramids and the Pentagon. Tell us a little bit about what it's about and give us a little bit. Aren't you from England? Aren't you a Brit?
Yeah, I'm originally from England. I grew up about 20 miles outside of the city of Birmingham in central England, but I've been over here in, I live just outside Dallas. I've been here about 12 years.
Okay.
So, you know, I've been here quite a while now, but get back quite often and sort of keep up with what's going on back in England, you know, with regard to UFOs, strange phenomena. And that story is actually quite an interesting one about, you know, the politician coming out and saying that. You know, we do get that occasionally, but not very often. But I actually do think it won't probably make that much difference, really. You know, it's kind of like the whole thing, you know, these photographs of Prince Harry that came out. Nobody in Britain could really care less. You know, it was just a joke. You know, they don't get outraged or anything by that. So I think it'll be the same. You know, as long as he can sort of balance the budget or whatever and, you know, keep education and crime fine in the town or whatever, nobody will really care that much. So,
well, you know how people are. They just care about their beer and sex. You know.
No, well, that's exactly, yeah. That's the important things in England. Sometimes in that order, sometimes the other order, but depends what mood people are in. But yeah, that and football as well, or soccer as it's called over here. So.
Yeah, right. So tell us about your book, Pyramids and the Pentagon. Tell us what it's about.
All righty. Well, it's basically, I'm sure everybody sort of listening to your show has heard of the whole ancient astronaut scenario that sort of recently got revamped in the last couple of years, you know, on a massive scale with the History Channel's Ancient Aliens show. You know, books have been written on this subject sort of going back decades, you know, certainly the most sort of visible example of this in the past was Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods, which is probably one of those books that sort of really defined, you know, when the whole ancient astronauts thing took off massively, if you like. And, you know, since then we've had a lot of other sort of well-known authors like Zechariah Sitchin and people like that. And I've always had an interest in this field, but never until now I've sort of written a book that covers the whole ancient astronauts controversy. And the reason I haven't is because, you know, a lot of good people have written a lot of good books on the subject anyway. And it was pretty much a case of, well, you know, what's the point of me doing one if it's just going to go over old ground that somebody else has covered? So I didn't want to, you know, just do that, you know, sort of pull 50 words from this book by von Daniken and 50 from another one by Zechariah Sitchin or whatever, you know, because that's cheating the audience. So I wanted to do something one of the days on it. And so I began looking around, and the more and more I began looking, the more I found a lot of information where there were snippets of stories that I was able to take further on one angle of the subject, which had never really been dug into to any great extent, and certainly not in book length. And that was not just the history of, you know, ancient astronauts and what might be going on, but what government agencies around the world know about the subject. And that sort of opened up doors to secret government files. And again, this is all through the Freedom of Information Act. Secret government files on how the pyramids were built, the CIA taking a deep interest in Noah's Ark and the Dead Sea Scrolls and Stonehenge with the British government, and a lot of weird, very weird stuff dealing with ancient mysteries and how the government was sort of deeply interested in trying to resolve, you know, what was going on in these situations.
Okay, let me ask you about what the Pentagon found in its research to determine if the pyramids of Egypt and the other massive stone structures from the past were actually constructed using levitation or anti-gravity. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is, you know, I guess it's a controversial area of research, but I mean, you know, if you look all around the world at the huge constructions, you know, that the ancients built, whether it was the pyramids in Egypt or the similar structures in Central and South America, Stonehenge in Britain, you know, various other Middle Eastern structures, ancient Rome, Greece, India, they all have evidence of cultures that sort of flourished and either vanished or were sort of, you know, incorporated into other cultures. But they built these incredible, you know, structures and buildings and sort of monuments, etc., that even today provoke a lot of controversy as to how the construction was actually achieved. You know, we hear a lot of talk from the sort of the more down-to-earth communities about rollers and ropes and pulleys and, you know, tree trunks laid over, you know, to roll things along, etc. And, you know, that's sort of the mainstream approach. But what's interesting is that if we look at all these cultures spanning from ancient Rome, Greece, Egypt, England, Central and South America, they all have kind of like a very similar story attached to how these structures were built. Now, bear in mind, you know, we're not talking about somebody just, you know, building a new brick wall in their backyard or whatever, you know, with a few fairly heavy rocks that's going to put your back out if you pick it up wrong. You know, we're talking about things that weigh like 20 or 30 tons, you know, some of these stones. The biggest stone at a place called Baalbek in the Middle East, this is, you know, the biggest carved stone on record. It's just round about 1,000 tons, you know. And some of these huge stones, when you start talking about rollers and planks and, you know, pulleys and rope, it really starts to get into, you know, areas that really it's just not feasible. You know, when you're talking about lifting these massive blocks, you know, 70, 80 feet in the air, you know, and put them on another block and another block and another block. And so, of course, people said, well, could there be another way that it's been done? And one of the things, as I said, that all the cultures around the world, they have one thing in common, and they're these stories that, what I'm going to say now will sound a bit odd until I explain it, but all these cultures have stories and legends and folklore about these massive stones being lifted by sound, or by to the sound of musical instruments or magical flutes and things like this. Now, you know, we shouldn't be taking these stories literally, that somebody play, you know, dances around with a magical flute and, you know, these stones rise into the air. You know, that might be how the mythology of it sounds, but that's not, you know, the reality. But what they're all these legends, what they're talking about, when, you know, they bear in mind a lot of these stories are passed down orally, you know, for generations, so they got distorted before they even made it, you know, into the sort of onto published manuscripts or parchments back then. But they all talk, as I said, about, you know, these stone blocks being raised by magical music to the tunes of sort of, you know, strange incantations and things like that. What they're basically talking about is something that's called acoustic levitation. And what it is, it's where you basically use sound frequencies. And it's kind of complicated, but in simplistic terms, it's where you have two opposing sound frequencies, and when they have what's called interfering sound waves, and in between the in between the sound waves, you have what's called a resonance zone, and the resonance zone basically allows for like an area where when you direct the sort of the sound wave, if you like, what happens is that you can raise objects within this resonant zone. And this has actually been achieved by the military, by the U.S. military on a number of occasions now, and with relatively small objects. But when you look into what they're actually talking about, the idea of this acoustic levitation, this sounds very much like what the ancients seem to have some sort of knowledge of, you know, in bygone times. And, you know, acoustic sound, the manipulation of sound, creating these resonant zones, you could easily understand how using sound to lift stones could become mythologized, if you like, to, oh, it was tunes and music, etc., but it's all tied in with sounds. And, you know, as I said, the military now is having some sort of rudimentary success in raising small objects in these resonant zones through sound frequencies and directed sound energy. And one of the things I found that, you know, back in the early 1950s even, when this sort of research began with a man, or not began, but was sort of really taken to a new level with a researcher named Maurice Jessop. Jessop wrote a book in the mid-50s called The Case for the UFO, which looked at this whole issue of, you know, levitation being utilized to raise the pyramids. And basically, what happened was that the military, the U.S. military, got very interested in the claims of Jessop and began basically watching him, listening to his lectures, and even invited him out to Washington, D.C. for sort of a clandestine interview about his research. And it becomes clear that they were very interested in these theories about ancient levitation and the pyramids and the pharaohs, and clearly from the perspective of trying to determine, you know, if this was a technology that the U.S. government could kind of weaponize, if you like.
Well, wasn't Maurice Jessop murdered because of his knowledge of what he was, what he had discovered?
Well, I mean, he certainly died under unusual circumstances. He was found dead in a Florida park in 1959 with like a hose pipe going from the exhaust of the car, of his car, through the window, you know, and he died from carbon monoxide poisoning. But he'd actually, ironically, the day before he was found dead, he'd sort of excitedly telephoned a colleague, a man named Dr. Manson Valentine, who was also heavily involved in ancient mystery research, and said he made a new breakthrough that he wanted to discuss with him the very next day. And rather conveniently, you know, the next day was when Jessop was found dead. So, you know, it's sort of a very, very controversial story. But, you know, I guess, unfortunately, sort of 53 years on, we'll probably never really know the truth of the matter. But, you know, there have been sort of whole books written, you know, suggesting that Jessop, you know, just didn't commit suicide, that there was something more sinister to it, possibly.
Well, wasn't he also involved in the Philadelphia experiment?
Yeah, he was. I mean, this is an interesting thing, you know, this whole idea of, you know, the Philadelphia experiment, this experiment that the Navy supposedly undertook in the Second World War to sort of create optical invisibility in their warships, and you know, the whole thing supposedly went wrong and the Navy shut the project down because they didn't really understand what they were dealing with. And that's sort of the, you know, the basic outline of the story. But Jessop wrote extensively about that as well, and you know, it's interesting that it was a Navy project, and it was actually the Navy that invited Jessop out to DC to discuss his pyramid theories. And the people he interviewed for were basically attached to, like, an advanced weapons project with the Navy. So they would also have been the ideal people to work on this Philadelphia experiment. And it seems they were sort of tapping his mind for information, because clearly somebody on the inside had been spilling secrets to him on the outside. And I think part of it was they wanted to understand the technology involved with the pyramids, but equally they wanted to know who was leaking information about the Philadelphia experiments. And, you know, to the Navy's sort of concern, you know, Jessop was talking about both these things and writing about them and, you know, sort of publicizing it here, there and everywhere. So he was probably someone who was being watched, I think, for at least a couple of reasons.
I'm also noticing that you have something written in the book about the CIA becoming interested in the 1947 discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Can you give us a little information about what you found out about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is sort of a very weird situation. You know, you would imagine that something like, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that would be an area of interest for sort of theologians, archaeologists, you know, people who study the Bible, historians, that kind of thing. not so much, the CIA or U.S. intelligence or the Pentagon. What on earth would they have an interest in the Dead Sea Scrolls? It just, doesn't make any sense at all until we sort of delve further into the story. But the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1947, which was an interesting year. It was the year in which the U.S. government passed the National Security Act, which sort of paved the way for the creation of the CIA. It was also the year of Roswell, and also the year when Kenneth Arnold had his famous sighting over, like, a fleet of UFOs over Washington State, which led to the creation of the word or the term flying saucer. So it's a very sort of historic period in our civilization's history. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, basically their discovery goes back to February 1947, at a place called Qumran, which is on the northwest side of the Dead Sea. And they, in number at least, they sort of pretty much, there's almost close to 1,000 of them. And they sort of represent early written material from pretty much every book of the Old Testament, dating from about 150 BC to 70 BC is when the scrolls are estimated to have been prepared. Now, today they're on public display at a place called the Shrine of the Brook, which is an arm of the Jerusalem-based Israel Museum. And, anyone can go and sort of see them. They're on public display there now. But one of the things that we do know is that in the summer of 1947, at the CIA's office in Damascus, which is the capital of Syria, the chief CIA operative there was a man named Miles Copeland. And he'd had sort of a background and a spy background in intelligence, etc., in the Second World War. And he became the CIA station officer in Damascus when the CIA was set up in 47. And he's gone on record speaking about how one particular day, this sort of mysterious character, this Bedouin-type character in these long, flowing robes, came into the building and said he had something that he wanted to show them, and could they get it analyzed for him? And, that was Copeland's job, to deal with sort of strange and unpredictable situations that might be of benefit to the CIA. So he said, well, what is it you've got? And this guy sort of pulled out this ancient parchment, which was all sort of rolled up. It was like one continuous long parchment, that you had to open up, sort of till it was like 15 feet long on the ground or whatever. And Copeland realized, this was something significant from an archaeological and historical perspective, but, he wasn't an expert in ancient languages by any means. But he had a colleague who was also attached to the CIA, or worked with them, I should say. His name was Kermit Roosevelt, and he was an expert on ancient Middle Eastern languages. So Copeland agreed to have it studied and analyzed, and that kind of pleased this mysterious character, who sort of left and said, well, I'll be back soon, and never returned. So we don't actually know where this particular scroll came from or how this character got hold of it. All we know is that he wanted to sort of basically give it to the CIA and then be done with it himself, which is, kind of intriguing also. Copeland photographed it, took a lot of photographs and sent the pictures, the negatives and the scroll off to the CIA, and never saw it again. It literally just vanished. And even to this day, the CIA, won't confirm on the record that they're holding this particular scroll. Now, of course, the big question is, why would they even, hold the scroll anyway? What's the big secret? Well, one of the things that Copeland heard was that the scroll in question related to the book of Daniel, and one particular part dealing with things like strange prophecies, weird dreams where things are prophesied, and, sort of signs in the mind that, were sort of forecasting future events and things like that. And we do know that over the years, the CIA has taken a very deep interest in sort of alternative, powers of the mind, like ESP and prophesizing things and that sort of stuff. So it may well be the case that the CIA was sort of keen to see this scroll because it coincided with when they began their sort of research into occult phenomena and paranormal phenomena. They may have wanted to take sort of the lead from what came before them, to see if there's any sort of tips and leads they could learn from them. And as I said, that scroll has never surfaced out of the vaults of the CIA, and we don't really know, exactly what it contains. But, for the CIA not to have released it, you know, for however long in itself is pretty interesting. So.
Oh, that's fascinating. Tell us a little bit about the story of Noah's Ark and how the U.S. government has taken so much interest in this project. I understand that they may think it's the remains of a crashed UFO. Is that true?
Yeah, this is one of the areas looked into. And just as one little aside before I get to that, one of the even stranger aspects of this story, that Miles Copeland, the CIA guy involved in the Dead Sea Scrolls situation, Miles Copeland, his son was Stuart Copeland, the drummer at the Police. You know, so there's like another tie there that people wouldn't even think of. You know, the drummer for the Police, his dad was, you know, involved in this weird biblical conspiracy story back in the 40s. So. But that has nothing to do with the story, of course. I just mentioned that. But yeah, when it comes to Noah's Ark, in a very different way, but equally weird sense, you know, this demonstrates the sort of the sheer scale and variety of ancient mysteries that elements of the U.S. government have dug into. The story of Noah's Ark and the U.S. government, and specifically the CIA, goes back to 1949, so pretty much 2 years after this whole situation with the CIA and the Dead Sea Scrolls. What happened was that on one particular summer's morning in 1949, a U.S. Air Force spy plane was flying across Turkey towards the border with the Soviet Union because intelligence gathering techniques had shown that the Russians were building up a new military base near the border of Turkey. And, of course, with Turkey being our friends, you know, this was of concern to the Turks and to the, you know, the Western world. And so a plan was basically initiated for a high-flying spy plane, a bomber, to fly as close to the border of Turkey and the Soviet Union as possible and photograph this base so, you know, they could determine how advanced it was and what was going to be kept there and did it pose a threat to the West, etc. And it so turned out that the guys on board this spy plane, they were flying over Turkey, but they had to fly close to Mount Ararat as a guiding point to get there. And, of course, Mount Ararat is the so-called alleged landing place of Noah's Ark after the sort of legendary flood as described in the Bible. And as they sort of approached the mountain, you know, they just anticipated getting on with the mission of photographing this base. But as they got close to the mountain, one of the guys on board the plane said he could see what looked like a huge wing sticking out the ice and snow at the top of the mountain. Now, you know, parts of Turkey get very, very hot, but, you know, Mount Ararat is like 17,000 feet high, and pretty much the entire, you know, major portion at the top is just covered in snow and ice, you know, all year round, literally. And they estimated that this huge wing-like object was about 600 feet long. As they swung round to photograph it, they could see actually on an adjacent side or an adjacent slope of the mountain, another wing-like structure, pretty much the same length, about 600 feet. Now, of course, if this was an aircraft, these wings would amount to an overall width of 1,200 feet, you know, 1,200 feet. There's no way that back then or now, you know, people aren't flying aircraft with wingspans of 1,200 feet. You know, it's just not going on. But that's what it looked like. So the crew quickly radioed, you know, back to headquarters and said, hey, you're not going to believe what we've just found, or words to that effect. And when they outlined it, the guys down at the base said, well, yeah, photograph it, get as many pictures as possible. So that's what they did. And then they went on with the original mission. All the photographs were developed and, not surprisingly, sort of vanished into the heart of the CIA and the Pentagon. And over the years, rumors have circulated about these photographs being sort of the beginning of a sort of a deep, long-term covert investigation of what might actually be buried deep on near the top of Mount Ararat. And within the CIA and the Pentagon, they don't actually refer to it as Noah's Ark. They actually have an official term for it. They call it the Ararat Anomaly. And that's why when people have tried to use the Freedom of Information Act and said, we'd like your files on Noah's Ark, the agencies have often said, we've checked and we don't have any files on Noah's Ark. And they can actually say that legitimately and truthfully because their files aren't titled Noah's Ark, they're titled Ararat Anomaly. And it sounds like splitting hairs, but that's how why you have to be very careful with the Freedom of Information Act, that you, if you're going to use it, you have to make sure you've got the right wording, or they can legally deny stuff because you haven't requested it properly. And it was only a few years ago that the term Ararat Anomaly was revealed as, you know, the official name, and then people started applying for documents, and some of the documents have surfaced, albeit, you know, to a limited degree. But what we do know over the years, that certainly the CIA has took the lead in this investigation of, you know, whatever is on Mount Ararat. Now, you know, it's kind of like within, I guess, the UFO research community or just the general public, you know, the people who work for the CIA, they're as human as the rest of us, and so, you know, all humans have opinions. And they studied these photographs, and there were some people who felt, well, maybe it's just like a large sheet of rock that happens to look like a wing, but that wasn't sort of very convincing. Other people wondered if it really was Noah's Ark, and other people thought, you know, could the story of Noah's Ark actually be like a distorted legend of like an alien ark that crashed on the Earth thousands of years ago? They were actually looking at the idea, you know, that what if there really was a huge flood in the distant past and visiting aliens knew about it, and so they took steps to try and, you know, preserve a significant amount of life in the event, you know, that the entire planet was sort of pulverized and swamped by these, you know, these huge floods, if you like, which, you know, arguably would make sense. And what's interesting is that, you know, contrary to what a lot of people think about, you know, the biblical story of Noah's Ark, pretty much every culture around the world has a flood legend. And more intriguingly, they all have stories about their own gods coming down and saying to one particular chosen person or a group of people, you know, you will take command of this particular ark and you'll take certain animals on board, etc., etc. You know, there's that, like the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example. I mean, that's a classic example. You can find stories from Wales, Denmark, Finland, Greece, Korea, Bolivia, Peru, Native American Indian tribes. They all have their stories of flood legends and the gods helping people to survive. Now, what's interesting is that in the biblical accounts, you know, that they talk about animals being taken on board the ark in sort of, you know, a two-by-two situation, if you like. Some of the other ones, and notably Gilgamesh, they don't talk about two-by-two animals being taken on board. They talk about the essence of the animals or the seed of life of the animals. And within the CIA, this actually gave rise to the theory, could it be that, you know, these arcs contain massive data banks of animal DNA, which, you know, would be far easier to, you know, have hundreds or thousands of data banks of DNA preserved rather than trying to get on, you know, to drag on board an ark to man-eating tigers or whatever, you know what I mean? That would be very difficult. If you look at it logically and logistically, you know, that is kind of hard to believe. But if you imagine a gigantic space ark, a data filled with, you know, like a data bank of thousands and thousands of animal DNA of different species, which could be used to sort of, you know, revamp and kickstart the planet after a natural disaster or whatever sort of disaster, you know, destroys, I don't know, 80-90% of the life on the planet and sort of re-sculpts the landscape, etc., and they did not need to start again, maybe these space arcs would be the things that would be used. And perhaps, some people in the CIA speculated, perhaps one of these arcs, you know, malfunctioned and crashed on Mount Ararat. And so, again, it seems like the impetus was, with the research into the pyramids, the impetus was to try and understand, well, if there's a crashed UFO on Mount Ararat, can we get our hands on the technology? And if we can we duplicate it and use it, you know? So unfortunately, you know, it wasn't to, none of this research has been done really to sort of further our knowledge of ancient history. It's all been done to try and build better and bigger weapons, basically. So.
Well, speaking of that, did the legendary Robert Oppenheimer, the brains behind the atomic bomb, have secret knowledge of a localized nuclear war fought in India possibly tens of thousands of years ago? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is probably one of the most controversial stories I talk about in the book. You know, Robert Oppenheimer was pretty much, you know, the brains and the father behind the atomic bomb. You know, the first atomic bomb was actually detonated at a place called the Trinity Site in New Mexico in 1945, not long before, you know, the two bombs that were dropped on Japan, on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which ended the war. So those were sort of the first three, you know, bombs that we basically exploded. And of course, the first one at the Trinity site, despite what a lot of people think, there actually wasn't a consensus on the part of the people who were involved in the Manhattan Project, which was the name of the plan to build the bomb. They didn't really know what was going to happen when they exploded that first one. It was a case of, well, let's do it in a remote place, you know, out in the New Mexico desert, and let's hope it's a big enough explosion, but not too big. You know, there were actually stories that, you know, could it destroy the planet? Could it, you know, throw the planet off its axis, its tilt, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they were really back then, you know, they're a little bit working in the dark and just hoping for the best. But when, you know, they saw the effects of it, it was like, well, you know, this could end the war. And, of course, history's shown that the bomb did end the war. But what's interesting is that we can go back to ancient India and find stories that sound eerily like somebody fought a very ancient nuclear war in the very, very distant past. And now that sounds bizarre, incredible, and, you know, like something out of a sci-fi novel, but, you know, there actually is like a lot of sort of written testimony that strongly kind of supports that scenario. You know, it's kind of, for people who've seen like the Planet of the Apes movie, the original one with Charlton Heston, you know, at the end of the film he stumbles upon this half-buried Statue of Liberty in the sand, you know, and realizes that the human race sort of destroyed itself thousands of years ago and has been reduced to kind of, you know, like cavemen, you know, being ruled by these talking apes, etc., you know, thousands of years further on. And to sort of delve into this story, we have to go again to India and two ancient historic texts that are sort of, you know, renowned within Indian culture, called the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Now, the main one that we need to focus on is the Mahabharata, which people have speculated, researchers, that, you know, it may date back as far as 8,000 years, which would be about 6,000 BC, which, you know, is a long time ago. Other researchers have suggested that that version of the Mahabharata may actually be based on an even older ancient text, possibly extending back 30, 40,000 years. And if that was true, you know, that would really push the barriers back as to when, you know, when people generally believe, you know, civilization began. You know, you go back more than about 6,000 years, and there actually isn't, you know, a great deal of knowledge as to who did what, when, and, you know, the time frame, etc. So if you push it back 40,000 years, you know, you're really in an era when we're just guessing for the most part. But, you know, with that said, the Mahabharata talks about this particular war. It's called the Kurukshetra War, which was fought in one particular area of northern India known as the Kuru. It was a culture known as the Kuru, but this war took place in northern India. And you would imagine, you know, with a multi-thousand-year-old war in northern India, a thousand-year-old war in northern India, that, you know, this would be fought with sort of horses, chariots, bows and arrows, spears, you know, shields, swords, that sort of thing. That's the sort of image that we would have for that era. But when you read the Mahabharata, it's actually nothing like that. It talks about this war being fought with these high-flying, fast-moving aircraft, which are piloted and actually fueled by mercury, which are called Vimanas, which is V-I-M-A-N-A. And basically, the Vimanas, if you read it sort of today, they sound like, you know, Top Gun aircraft, you know, sort of dogfighting over the Middle East, you know, with the enemy, etc. And they also talk about these Vimanas having the ability to unleash these sort of all-powerful, destructive iron rods that would slam into the cities. And when that would happen, you know, the entire city for miles would just be flattened. And there would be this massive flash all across the landscape. There would be this incredibly high pillar of smoke, which would just loom in the sky, you know, like for 2 miles high for days. And it would be so much smoke and dust and dirt would be kicked up that the sky would go black, the temperature would drop. And in the immediate hours and afterwards, soldiers in the vicinity and people in the vicinity would start to fall sick and die. Now, you know, if we look at this, these are all sort of ancient descriptions of what eerily sounds like the effect of a nuclear attack. You know, it's kind of like in the events, you know, let's hope it never happens, but in the events of, you know, a nuclear war, there are a number of things that we know what would happen. You know, you would have these massive explosions, and you'd have this sort of looming, ominous mushroom cloud that everybody's seen pictures of. You know, you imagine like a 5-mile-high mushroom cloud over, you know, a major city just looming there for days. Well, one of the things that scientists have speculated would happen in a worldwide nuclear war is that so many, literally billions and billions of tons of dust and dirt would be thrown up into the atmosphere that it would actually cause what's known as a nuclear winter. And the temperature of the planet could literally plummet, you know, by 40 or 50 degrees for maybe 6, 7, 8 years, you know, to where whole swathes of the planet would just die off. You know, people just, and animals and plants just wouldn't be able to thrive. You know, you imagine Africa down to about 30 degrees or something, 20 degrees for 10 years. And, of course, you know, then you have the very distressing effects of radiation poisoning. You know, it's like you think you're safe in your house because you missed the blast, but your windows got blown wide open and destroyed. Before you know it, 3 hours later, you know, you're vomiting blood because, you know, you've just been saturated with radiation. And that's what it sounds like in these ancient stories, that, you know, the mushroom cloud, the flash, the soldiers dying in the hours and days afterwards. And what's even more intriguing is that Robert Oppenheimer was actually obsessed with the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. He could quote word for word at length from it. And he actually he came to regret developing the atomic bomb, and that was one of the reasons why he was, in the early 50s, thrown out of the program. He lost his security clearance because he began to think, you know, he kind of felt like Dr. Frankenstein, you know, he'd unleash this monster on the world and wish he could, you know, put the genie back in the bottle, if you like. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was that, you know, he became obsessed with this. And interestingly enough, at a conference or a seminar in Washington, D.C. in the early 50s, somebody asked him, you know, when were the first atomic bombs detonated? Were they the ones in New Mexico, the one in New Mexico and the two in Japan? And Oppenheimer said, yes, those were the first, but then he paused and he added, in modern times, as if to say, well, they were our first, but not necessarily the first in the history of the human race. And he alluded to this on several occasions, you know, the idea that perhaps he'd learned something through working in the official world, that maybe our civilization wasn't the first to develop atomic weapons, and maybe, you know, long, long time ago, way into prehistory, perhaps somebody else came along before us, not necessarily on a worldwide basis, but perhaps localized in certain parts of the world, and who flourished and destroyed themselves, and all we've got left today, you know, is a bit of folklore and these kind of suspicions that Oppenheimer held.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'd like to take the topic now to George Van Tassel. You know, George Van Tassel, mm-hmm, and I spent a great deal of time together. He really trained me on so many different things before he died. In fact, when he did die, I was called by his wife, Doris, to come and mm-hmm, and help her, and I put together the memorial and everything that happened right after that. So mm-hmm, I noticed that one of the things that you talk about is that the FBI wanted mm-hmm to investigate the claims of George Van Tassel that aliens had seeded our earliest civilization. So can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I can. Actually, it's interesting, you know, you told me all that about your background with him because, you know, I've been to the Integratron and, you know, Giant Rock on a number of occasions because the whole period of the contactees, you know, I wasn't around then, but it sort of fascinates me, you know, that whole period. And I know a lot of people write the contactees off, but I don't. I think, you know, a lot of them had genuine sort of, you know, mystical experiences, particularly out in some of these desert locations like Giant Rock. And I think, you know, it's there's sort of that legacy there even today when you go back, where, you know, we sort of need to preserve that legacy because I think a lot of people are new to the UFO subject don't appreciate, you know, that movement and that era. You know, it's sort of unfortunately been very much elbowed out, I think. And so, you know, I think what we can do to sort of, you know, sort of push that ear and demonstrate that, you know, it should still sort of, you know, the flag should still fly for it, I think is a good thing. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, the FBI opened an extensive file on George Adamski, it began in 1953 and continued till I think it was 1967. So it's like 14 years, a decade and a half of watching him. And the file that the FBI has on him, I think it's about 400 pages long, so it's pretty extensive. But one of the most extensive entries in the overall file is a document from 1960. Well, basically, in April 1960, Van Tessel gave a very lengthy speech at a place called the Phipps Auditorium in Denver, Colorado. And this had been organized by a local UFO research group called the Denver Unidentified Flying Objects Investigative Society. And it was advertised on local radio in advance and newspapers, etc. And, of course, the FBI heard about it, and they sent an agent along to sort of sit in the audience, And this often happens, quite regularly. And, of course, they don't give themselves away by turning up dressed like the Men in Black or whatever, They turn up in jeans and T-shirts or whatever and just sit there like any member of the audience, They want to blend in. But what we know is that, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, that there was at least one FBI agent and possibly two in attendance at this lecture, and they prepared extensive or recorded extensive notes clearly at the lecture, and then prepared an even longer report for J. Edgar Hoover himself, talking all about what Van Tassel was, saying about alien life visiting the Earth today. But they were also particularly interested in the fact, and cited this in the report on several occasions, that one of the main areas that he focused upon was in relation to UFOs and religious issues. And they talk about how Van Tassel had supposedly been told by his alien contacts that there'd been a number of sort of cataclysmic events in Earth's history where aliens had intervened and sort of either been aware that these events were going to occur, they had advance notice, or when they did occur, took steps to try and salvage some of the early primitive human civilizations and animals. And Van Tassel said that, this also sort of led to some of the stories about Noah's Ark and things like this. And interestingly enough, the FBI quoted heavily on his research into Noah's Ark and, the idea that's kind of similar to what the CIA was following up on, the idea that it was a space ark rather than just an old wooden ark. And Van Tassel also claimed that Adam and Eve, the story of Adam and Eve, rather than being sort of one man and one woman, that these were the names of like two ancient races that were sort of brought together. And, there was this sort of, genetic development of a cross between, the more primitive humans and sort of sophisticated, more advanced space beings, if you like. Kind of, almost like the Nephilim, the gods coming down, etc., and, seeing the humans and mating with them, etc. It's kind of like a similar thing, but he was, putting it in a definitively UFO context. And he also talked about, Jesus being born of Mary and Mary supposedly being essentially like an extraterrestrial being. So he covered a lot of controversial area. And of course, in sort of 1950s, early 60s America, to sort of stand up on a stage and say all that, you got to be a pretty, a good, strong character. And the FBI sort of recorded all this and prepared this statement. And as I said, it's clear that, their main area of concern was how these theories and ideas might influence U.S. culture and society. They clearly, I think, didn't want to see the status quo upset. They wanted the sort of the biblical stories to remain intact and not, as they saw it, sort of infected by stories of flying saucers. But I mean, the interesting thing about Van Tassel, that he was saying all this in the late 50s and early 60s, this is like 10, 15 years before the real pop, the big popular ancient astronaut stuff kicked off in the 70s, So in other words, Van Tassel was very much, the sort of definitive prophet, if you like, when it comes to talking about this sort of stuff.
Well, when I was, every time I was at his house there close to Giant Rock, there was, we could see the agents up on the hill. They had a little cabin that they had built. And they were sitting up there with binoculars and taking pictures of everything that we did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
As you were saying that, I thought, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
And, of
well,
course,
for
people that have not heard my story, Crack Between the Worlds, it's on the archives of our radio show, and it is the story of my time with George Van Tassel and what all happened there at Giant Rock. For those that have not listened to it, go back and listen to that. Now I'd like to take attention to what's the link between the National Security Agency, crop circles, mm-hmm. and the Mayan prophecies concerning the 2012 end of the world controversy. Mm.
Yeah,
this is
sort of a very weird one. You know, it's almost like the sort of thing that, you know, you couldn't make up because it is so weird. It's a very, very odd story, you know, and sort of covers some ominous areas. I mean, for as long as crop circles have sort of existed in sort of large scale and, you know, as a part of popular cultures from sort of the late 1980s onwards, when, you know, more of these formations began to appear in fields, particularly in the south of England and predominantly in the county of Wiltshire, there have always been these rumours about sort of covert government interest in crop circles, you know, that the government is trying to find out who's building them or creating them and why. And one of the things that, you know, I thought, well, if there's anything to this, I'll use the Freedom of Information Act to try and find out if government agencies, you know, have looked into crop circles. And I was actually surprised to find a number of files. Not because I wasn't surprised that they were involved. I was actually surprised and pleased to actually get hold of the files. You know, that was the thing that surprised me, that the government relevant agencies released them. But what kind of surprised me most of all was that some of these files, the British ones, actually went back right to the Second World War, where military pilots flying from Britain towards Europe and coming back again, you know, to bomb Germany, they reported seeing these massive, weird-looking formations in the fields as they were flying towards Germany. And, of course, back then, they had this sort of ingenious theory, you know, could they be like coded messages designed for German bomber pilots? You know, this design means approach London at midnight at 2,000 feet and, you know, drop your bombs on Buckingham Palace or whatever. But, of course, you know, that theory was never proved, and it later turned out that the Germans thought they were sort of British coded messages. So, you know, everybody thought somebody else was doing them. But what's important is that these files demonstrate two things. One, that the phenomenon's far older than many people realize, and the other one, that government agencies have taken an interest in the subject. And actually, you know, I reproduced some of these files in the book. But to sort of bring things up to date, I mentioned that in the book because it sort of demonstrates a background and proof that government agencies have taken an interest. Now, the one, as it relates to 2012, is a very weird situation. Basically, a few years ago, in around about 2005, 2006, a number of formations, you know, these massive pictograms, began to appear in British fields that seemed to show evidence of links to the sort of the old Mayan prophecies about 2012 and, you know, the sort of the end of an era on December the 21st of this year. You know, they had sort of Mayan themes, drawings, iconography and imagery, etc. And, of course, you know, that inevitably led to the idea or the theory, are the crop circles or the constructors behind them trying to warn us of some impending situation in 2012? And the National Security Agency heard rumors that, you know, this was being sort of done deliberately to sort of invoke sort of anxiety on the part of the, you know, the population. And, you know, they wondered, well, are these formations made, you know, by some paranormal form? Is it aliens? They even addressed the theory, you know, could it be like radical terrorists or somebody that were sort of enlisting people to make them to try and fulfill the old prophecies and frighten people, you know, create a sense of terror. You know, that's what terrorists do. So that they were looking at a whole range of weird angles and collected. The interesting thing about the file is that it's not so much a file full of deep analysis. It's like a collection of newspaper and magazine articles where they had very deeply and systematically obviously been reviewing pretty much every published article on crop circles in Britain for like 5 or 6 years and carefully logging all those that even remotely mentioned the 2012 phenomenon. So, you know, we have this sort of bizarre situation of some of the sort of top spies and code breakers in the US government, you know, spending their their hours, their jobs, you know, analyzing old Mayan prophecies in relation to crop circles in England. Now, of course, you know, the thing is with the Mayan prophecies, why they're sort of so on the minds of so many today is because of, well, you know, it's August now, nearly September, and, you know, the prophecies supposedly get fulfilled in December. It's hardly, you know, something that we don't need to worry about or think about for another 100 years or whatever. But, you know, the one thing that's got a lot of people sort of concerned, or at least, you know, wondering if something might happen, is that, you know, the Mayas believe that, you know, the world sort of developed in cycles. And they believe that December the 21st, 2012, sort of marks the end of the next cycle in the human race. And, of course, it's that very word, you know, just that one word alone that has kind of, you know, given rise to the idea, well, what does cycle mean? Now, contrary to a lot of people think, you know, there's actually nowhere at all in any of the Mayan prophecies does it say, you know, that the world's going to end, or there's going to be huge tsunamis or comets hitting the planet or meteorites or earthquakes or massive volcanoes. It doesn't say that at all. It just says the end of a cycle. And, of course, you know, you could, I guess, you know, suggest a cycle is, you know, some planet-wide cataclysm, but you could equally argue, you know, could it be like a spiritual changing? Could it be a renewed appreciation for the planet where we all have a different mindset? You know, it could be one of many things, you know, or it could be nothing. You know, people have also speculated on to what extent the date calendar has been interpreted versus, you know, the actual calendar, so to speak. So, you know, we are very much in, you know, delving into sort of uncharted territory. But I guess, you know, the one thing we can say for sure is that the NSA deeply looked into this 2012 angle. And the other thing is, if anything happens, well, we're going to know pretty soon. So,
yeah, we're sitting on it, aren't we? You know, since you're from England, mm-hmm. have you spent time at Stonehenge? And what do you know about the British government secretly investigating the mysteries of Stonehenge?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to go down, you know, to Wiltshire, the county where most of the crop circles appear every year. I used to go down there, you know, every summer from about 92 to about 2000. And I left England in 2001. So, yeah, probably 92 to about 2000. And Wiltshire is a very interesting county because it's not only, you know, where most of the crop circles appear, but it's also home to Stonehenge. And also another famous circle called the Avebury Circle, which has many more stones than Stonehenge, but, you know, they're nowhere near as big. But, you know, you can find these stone circles all around the British Isles, and while Stonehenge is certainly, you know, the tallest, etc., I mean, some of them, you know, they have like a diameter of 8 feet, you know, and the stones are like 18 inches high. That's literally how small some of them are. Others are huge. But one of the things I found doing the research was that the British Ministry of Defence took deep interest in some of these ancient formations, particularly Avebury and Stonehenge, and another one called the Rollright Stones, which is another famous stone circle in Britain. And the reason they took an interest was because they'd heard stories, some of which actually involved their own military personnel, because where Stonehenge is situated in Wiltshire, it's on an area called Salisbury Plain. And Salisbury Plain is, I mean, it literally, you know, it's dozens of square miles, and part of it is actually falls under the jurisdiction of the British Ministry of Defence, and the general public isn't allowed on it. So it's where the military conducts all its manoeuvres and, you know, military exercises. And because it's so close to Stonehenge, there are a number of stories where the military had heard that some of their personnel on these manoeuvres late at night seemed to have been affected in some way in the proximity of Stonehenge, where they started to have sort of weird visions of just all sorts of strange stuff, from strange-looking creatures to, you know, to everything that, you know, you could kind of imagine, like something straight out of like a horror movie to, you know, like a floating angel, all different things. You know, different people seem to envisage or hallucinate a different thing. And the Ministry of Defence, or a team within the Ministry of Defence, came to the sort of conclusion that there seemed to be powers associated with these stones, if you like. They had the ability to manipulate the human mind to where eventually, if you like, or in theory, could could affect the human mind and basically cause it to see anything that this phenomenon wanted it to see. You know, it was like projecting like a holographic image into our minds, which we would then sort of externalize and see in like a visionary style. And the Ministry of Defense, like the U.S. government, thought, well, hang on, you know, if we could understand this skill or this technology or power, whatever it is, we could weaponize it. You know, they were thinking of the idea of, you know, could we make the enemy think it's seeing, you know, 10,000 troops coming towards them when there's actually nobody there? You know, that was the line of thinking. But the program basically stalled because they just could not understand what this sort of ancient, latent energy was. You know, it wasn't like it was a machine that they could tinker with and play around with and try and get it going. You know, it was almost like there was some magical, ethereal energy surrounding the stones that was causing these visions. And of course, it's like, how do you harness and understand an energy that you know, has no sort of physical property to it? And so they basically came to the conclusion that, yes, something was going on, that there seemed to be some sort of energies around the stones that did have the ability to affect human perception and create visions and hallucinations, but they couldn't harness it. They didn't know how to sort of take hold and utilize something that, you know, just didn't have any form to it. But they believed that, you know, clearly the ancient man knew something of this energy and knew how to use it and manipulate it in ways that, you know, we today, we might have all our machines or whatever, but we've forgotten this more sort of earth-based magical energy, if you like. You know, we've just gone down the nuts and bolts energy path, I guess.
Well, that reminds me of Project Bluebeam. Wouldn't you say that was kind of a takeoff on that?
Yeah, actually it is. I mean, Project Bluebeams, you know, this controversial story, you know, about the idea of somebody in government wanting to sort of fake a religious event, you know, to sort of manipulate the population, you know, into basically enslaving the population, you know, by faking like a second coming. Now, people say, well, you know, that sounds just too conspiratorial. But one of the things I point out in the book, and this has actually surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, is that back in the early 1960s, a man named General Edward Lansdale, who was a sort of very brilliant man within the U.S. military, and he came up with all sorts of different and weird and wonderful plans to sort of defeat and deceive the enemy. He came up with this plan when the whole Cuban Missile Crisis thing was going on, you know, and the plans to assassinate Fidel Castro, etc. Lansdale came up with the idea of faking a second coming of Jesus over Cuba and to make it seem that God was on the side of the United States. Now, that sounds bizarre, but what he actually did, the plan was to have these sort of small boats approach the coast of Cuba late at night, where on a specific occasion when there were like low-hanging clouds, thick clouds, and project using, you know, like a cinematic projector, project images of Jesus onto the clouds and have an aircraft fly through the clouds with its engine muffled and one of the guys on board broadcasting with a loud speaker saying, people of Cuba, you know, this is Jesus, stand up against your leader, that kind of thing. You know, it sounds totally off the wall and over the top. And it actually didn't work. You know, the logistics were probably just, you know, the weather would have to be right. They would have to make sure they didn't get caught doing it or that the technology worked. But they were actually planning to do this, to fake a second coming, to try and get the Cubans to rise up against Fidel Castro. Now, this was 50 years ago. You know, in the period since then, we've gone a long way from sort of cinematic projections onto clouds and loudspeakers. You know, in today's world, there's, you know, a great deal of advancement has been made in the field of sophisticated holograms, you know, and it is possible, you know, to make extremely eerily real-looking holograms. And, you know, this has sort of given more and more rise to this idea of sort of like a religious deception, you know, to sort of not unify everybody in like a rejoicing state, but, you know, unify them under like a martial law type of situation instigated by a second coming. You know, it does sound like the, you know, the ultimate sci-fi novel, but a number of people have said, you know, well, the theory has been addressed. Now, whether people believe it or not, the Edward Lansdale story in Cuba, that can be utterly 100% verified because, as I point out in the book, you know, the files have now surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. So half a century on, you know, fairly ominous, you know, fairly ominous terms, it's difficult to deny that something might, you know, not be going on, you know, along those lines.
Well, you know, in 1985, I was in Costa Rica, and mm-hmm. I actually got to witness the demonstration of Project Bluebeam when they put the figure of Jesus up in the clouds and had people just
mm-hmm.
falling all over the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
to witness it in 1985, in February of 1985.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, you know, it's in religious countries, religion controls people, you know. It's one of these situations where, you know, for people who, you know, are religious, I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I'm not a particularly religious person, but people who are, you know, it should be, even I would admit, you know, it should be an uplifting, joyous experience. But unfortunately, and it's becoming more and more like this today, you know, and I think whether people like what I'm about to say or not, but I think they would agree that religion today is becoming more like a tool of manipulation and control. You know, it's like the fear factor, the guilt factor, you know, it's, and I think instead of being something that people should be able to enjoy and appreciate if they want to go down that path, you know, it is becoming more like a controlling tool. And I think that's the big danger, is when you have a powerful small body of people manipulating what should be something, you know, of a celebratory nature, you know, but to say, you know, project these huge images in the sky and then, you know, put the people under some sort of state of control because people are, you know, the entire nation or whatever is freaking out. You could understand how quickly, you know, it could actually all fall into place, because when people panic, they look for help, you know, and they're willing to give up this right or that right. You know, you only have to look at the world today, how quickly people are, you know, so many people say, you know, you hear this all the time, well, I don't care if the government listens in on my phone, I've got nothing to hide. Well, you know, that's an appalling thing to say. Nobody should be listening on your phone. You know, if you've got nothing, if you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't be listened to. You know, you shouldn't have to put up with it. It shouldn't happen in the first place, you know.
That's right. I'd like to take a minute just for our, you know, our whole audience is really quite awake and they've been studying for years. And I noticed that you talk about the Pentagon opening a file on Edgar Cayce, who mm. was, you know, a great psychic, and his mm. research into the tales and legends of Atlantis. And I've talked mm. about Atlantis a lot on Starseed Radio Academy. Mm. Give us what you think was up to about Edgar Cayce.
Yeah, well, I mean, Edgar Cayce, you know, he was one of the, without doubt, you know, one of the United States' most well-known and famous psychics, you know, and he still has a massive following to this day. You know, he died in 1945, and, you know, you can go to Virginia Beach, you know, where the Edgar Cayce Foundation exists. I went there about, I think about 7 years ago, you know, had a cool afternoon, you know, just wandering around it and sort of taking in, you know, all the old history and... you know, it was a sort of cool way to spend an afternoon, you know, and I've never sort of forgotten it. But, you know, he was also someone who was deeply interested in the stories and legends relative to Atlantis. You know, he kind of also took on board the idea of, you know, like a planet engulfing flood, which, you know, sort of destroyed whole regions of the planet, and, you know, how there were these ancient mighty civilizations like the Atlanteans, etc. And he believed that, you know, possibly parts of the remnants of Atlantis or the people of Atlantis after one of these huge disasters possibly were responsible for sort of, I guess, moving to Egypt. And then, you know, the Egyptians inherited some of their technology and, you know, developed the pyramids in that situation. But one of the things that we know is that the CIA actually infiltrated in the 1960s the Edgar Cayce Foundation. You know, exactly for what purpose, we don't know. But, I mean, the mere act of infiltrating it, you know, demonstrates that, you know, that potentially they had access to who knows how many files and documents and people's names and everything else. And again, you know, this shows that if the CIA was interested and infiltrated the organization, then they were clearly on the search for something. And the very fact that Casey was so focused on ancient mysteries, that makes a lot of sense, because historically we know the CIA was looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls and Noah's Ark and the pyramids from the 40s through the 50s. So it wouldn't at all be a stretch to think that they would be looking at Edgar Casey in the 60s. You know, it's sort of like a continuation of this whole investigation into the mysteries of the past. And so in that sense, you know, it's it adds another strand and a thread to this bigger picture. But again, you know, what it also shows is that they weren't sort of leaving any stones unturned in trying to pretty much follow up on every aspect of trying to determine who knew what, you know, about the mysteries of the past.
Well, we all seem to have some memories of Atlantis, a lot of us that have been talking recently, and I'm in some of the sessions that I have with people. It seems that the Atlantis legends just keeps coming about. I would like to now turn the program over to you, Ariel, and Anastasia. I'll talk to you later, Nick.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you, Lavendar, and we are going to be taking questions here in a few minutes, so if you do have a question or comment that you would like to pose to Nick, then you need to press 1 on your keypad so that we know that you have a question or comment. And just continuing on the Edgar Casey thing, having been there and looked through what the archives have, did he actually give any kind of facts and figures concerning Atlantis?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these situations with Casey that, you know, I mean, he wrote, you know, numerous books. I mean, you know, you can, if you just, you type his name into Amazon or something, you know, you'll find an extraordinary number of books on, you know, a whole variety of different psychic phenomena. But, I mean, he was very sort of vocal and detailed, you know, on things like Atlantis. For example, he claimed to have been sort of the reincarnation of an Egyptian priest named Rata, supposedly the creator of a healing center in Egypt known as the Temple of Sacrifice. And Casey claimed that, you know, the Egyptians, rather than having the conventional story of, you know, having built the pyramids, he came to believe they sort of inherited these structures, that they may have been far older and actually developed and built, you know, by a surviving relic of the Atlantean civilization after it was destroyed, you know, and that the Egyptians kind of, you know, took it on board thousands of years later, or took them on board thousands of years later. And what's interesting is that Casey also believed that a huge hall of records, if you like, was located under the right paw of the Sphinx. And this story circulated for a long time. And what's interesting is that a number of years ago, Robert Schock, who's done a lot of research into the Sphinx, revealed that him and his team had actually discovered clear evidence of what was sounded like a cavity or a chamber under the left paw of the Sphinx. And, you know, the very fact that decades earlier Casey was talking about some sort of hall of records buried in one of the paws of the Sphinx, you know, you have to sort of give him credit that he was, you know, he'd come up with this discovery or this statement long before Robert Schock actually, you know, sort of discovered evidence of some sort of cavity in one of the paws of the Sphinx. So, you know, I think possibly this is one of the reasons why, you know, the CIA was watching Casey, because he made a number of specific statements, you know, that you can actually tie to today's world. You know, it wasn't sort of rambling, just off-the-wall statements that could be interpreted in different ways. You know, he was saying some sort of hall of records in the Sphinx's paw. Then we find this cavity decades later in the Sphinx's paw. So, you know, I think this all demonstrates why he was watched, because he showed a lot of perception, I think.
Mm-hmm. They wanted to know what else he knew.
Yeah,
to see if it could be exploited.
Well, yeah, and I think also, although a lot of it clearly was about weaponry, I think they were also interested and concerned, you know, to know if there were civilizations before ours, if aliens visited the Earth, or was it a combination of the two? You know, were there alien visitations at the same time that there existed, you know, highly advanced terrestrial civilizations. You know, I think they were trying to find the answers to both, to all those questions, but at the end of the day, a lot of it did come down to how can we make this into something to, you know, make an even bigger explosion or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Nick, this is Anastasia. I just wanted to point out that this reminds me so much. It's not unlike how the Vatican has an observatory here in the United States, one of the largest observatories. And the reason I bring that up is that knowledge is power. And here we have, you know, your status quo leadership groups. We have the church and we have state who are looking for information that in their daily talk they would not necessarily admit, well, they don't admit to, as you well brought out. A lot of this is clandestine and done with our tax dollars, I might add. Tremendous amounts of funds being channeled into these kinds of investigations because, indeed, knowledge is power. And it's just very interesting to me because it seems clear that, you know, although the official stance is one direction, you know, such as conventional wisdom and what they want people to believe, but clearly they're very aware that there is much more to our history and to reality than meets the eye. And, you know, you mentioned weaponization of technologies, and yet, and by the way, they are doing that. There's a great deal of activity already going on with this, some of these invisibility projects that they're working on with, you know, a camouflage. And the technologies have become so incredibly, just incredibly intricate and advanced that it hardly seems possible that even our modern scientists could have come up with this on their own. And I just wonder what you think about possibly what they might have learned from all of their research and studying and so on about technology that may be contributing to the advancement of the technology that we see going on today. Do you think some of that they've learned from secret sources? Have you thought about that?
Oh, yeah, I don't doubt that at all. I mean, you know, it's one of these situations where, you know, of course we have brilliant scientists who are capable of doing things on their own, but when we see evidence of, you know, research into alternative and novel technologies that are described in ancient books and ancient texts, then it becomes clear that, you know, there's like a sort of a two-pronged approach. There's the stuff that we're doing now, and there's a sort of a look back at these stories and thinking, well, you know, this kind of sounds like this, and sort of, you know, they're using it as sort of like an impetus or inspiration to try and use these ancient stories as, you know, and determine what's going on. I think the big problem, of course, is that unless they actually find evidence of one of these ancient technologies, you know, a lot of it is going to be based around suspicions and ideas and theories that how this sort of technology was developed and achieved. But, you know, unless you find like the equivalent of a, you know, a 40,000 year rusted old jet plane, you know, buried under the Egyptian sands, it's like how much of it becomes theoretical versus how much can actually be developed. But I think what they've probably done, if they haven't found evidence, you know, hard physical nuts and bolts evidence of these ancient technologies, which they may have done, but if they haven't, I think the important thing is that these, what they can learn from the legends still allows them to use those ideas and themes, like the acoustic technology. You know, it's clear from the files that government personnel realize that these stories about magical music and magical instruments, they concluded that, you know, this was like one of these acoustic sonic technology machines. But over centuries of, you know, passing the story down through local village and town, etc., it got distorted from sonic technology to sound to music, etc. So I think, you know, they're learning a lot from just the legends themselves, never mind just the technology itself. So,
you know, but when we consider the amount of money available to them and that so often they're the first on the scene.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, we just, I mean, really, it seems to me to be highly likely that they have definitely acquired a whole lot of information that they're keeping from the public. And like I said, knowledge is power. This is, you know, essentially to have the power because that is really critical, whether they weaponize it or they
mm-hmm.
have secret knowledge about the truth of humanity's history, whatever. Mm-hmm. This is information that should be shared with everybody, but we're the last to know.
Well, you're right, unfortunately. I think, you know, when it comes to these ancient mysteries, I think governments know a lot, they suspect a lot, and they're determined to keep most of us, unless, you know, these ancient power-based families, etc., you know, which actually wield more power than governments, you know, this sort of network of, you know, these powerful families and organizations and almost like cults, you know, that they're the ones who really pull the strings and know what's gone on in the background. And they're the ones, I think, more than, say, you know, this agency of the government or this arm of the military.
Sure.
You know, they're just following orders, so to speak.
Sure.
You know, but
mm-hmm. These are just,
you know,
tools. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that applies to all this as well. You know, there's a bigger picture that possibly we're not seeing the entire issue, you know, of why there's so much interest in the past.
I think it's pretty ironic that, you know, the governments are interested in all of these ancient mysteries and ancient secrets and, you know, ancient technologies and
mm-hmm.
all these things. But at the same time, if anyone outside, you know, like you or I, make theories, then it's preposterous. The same thing, you know, that they're debunking, they really are interested in. It's like, yes, there's no such thing as UFOs, and they keep saying that, and the more they say it, the more ridiculous it sounds, because we know that they're into this stuff.
You're right.
And what about the connection between ancient Egypt and Mars?
Well, that's an interesting one. You know, I mean, much of this relates to the story of the so-called face on Mars, you know, this famous structure that I think, you know, everybody's sort of seen, this image of what looks like a human-like face staring up eerily from the surface of Mars in a place called Cydonia. And the face on Mars was sort of first photographed, officially at least, in 1976, and by Viking 1, NASA's Viking 1 probe. And NASA doesn't publicly, you know, avoid talking about the face on Mars. They've actually got a section for it on their website. But they say, oh, it's just the equivalent of people seeing faces in clouds. You know, just because it looks like a face, it's just, you know, the stones, the rocks, the shadows, etc., makes it look like a face when the sun's in the right position, etc. But there's a very sort of strong argument against that particular situation. And one of the reasons is that, you know, the face looks eerily like the Egyptian Sphinx, but whereas, you know, the face on Mars stares upwards, you know, the Sphinx of Egypt stares outwards. But in the same region, in Cydonia, you have what look very much like pyramid-type structures as well. You know, NASA make claims about sort of powerful winds sort of sculpting the rocks at angles, etc., creating these sort of angled hills or whatever. But, you know, when you look at them, the aerial pictures blown up, they kind of look like somebody's flown over Egypt, you know, at 10,000 feet, you know, that they look like you would expect to see in Egypt. And so the very fact that you have this Sphinx-type structure in the very same vicinity where you have these pyramid-type structures, inevitably this has sort of given rise to the idea or the theory, could there be some sort of connection between Mars and Egypt? You know, we have the story of the Egyptian gods coming down. You know, one theory is, could they actually have been visiting Martians, you know, who basically upgraded, you know, the more primitive people, and, you know, the primitive people were encouraged to sort of absorb some of the original Martian architecture, you know, that perhaps even the Martians taught the indigenous people how to build, and because the Martians wanted to, you know, retain some aspect of their culture, they showed them how to do pyramids and things like that. You know, it's a wild theory, but I mean, I don't think we can rule it out. And of course, the other theory is that possibly, you know, I don't rule out the idea that today Mars possesses some sort of life. You know, I think there's evidence there could be life on Mars even now, but clearly it is a harsh environment. Now, if there were people similar to us on Mars, and, you know, at some point in its distant past, the atmosphere began to degrade and the Martians had advanced knowledge, you know, they may well have been able to sort of launch like an emergency flotilla of craft to the Earth, you know, and just hope for the best and land wherever they felt they were able to and just hope for the best and start over. If that was the case, you know, it's like if that happened to us, we and our Earth got destroyed, we would at least want to be able to start over with some remembrance of our home planet and try and salvage something. Maybe that would be in architecture, you know. So perhaps what we're seeing in Egypt and some of these other cultures in South America, in India, etc., with these massive structures, is an attempt by some race that was doomed on some faraway world coming here and starting over and being interpreted as, you know, the gods coming down and helping the people. But, I mean, there are a lot of anomalies on Mars. For example, if you type into Google Banyan tree, B-A-N-Y-A-N, Banyan tree plus Mars, you'll see these weird photographs, which actually NASA have declassified, which seem to show sort of bushes and trees on the surface of Mars. The pictures actually look like somebody's flown over Nevada in a plane and photographed an area, you know, where there's some vegetation. That's what they look like. And NASA said, "Oh no, it's, you know, if you're in front of a computer and you can type in Banyan tree plus Mars, you'll see it into Google Images. You'll see them, and they look weird. They kind of almost look like sponges under the water, that kind of thing. But they look like how you might imagine an alien tree would look like. And you see in some shots what look like entire orchards of these things on the Martian surface. And so when you've got things like that and sort of anomalous stone structures, I don't think we can rule out the idea that, you know, maybe there's like a Mars-Earth connection somewhere in our distant past, and maybe there are even people at an official level who secretly know this or suspect it. But, you know, the ramifications might be so controversial and huge that they just sort of prefer to, you know, stamp on the story at all costs and bury it, basically.
We had another a guest some time ago, Robert Morningstar, who does a lot of Mars reporting, and he further went to say that the structures that look like pyramids on Mars are located with the exact same orientation as the three pyramids on at Giza. They're placed equally distant in the same formation as it is here. So that's beyond coincidence.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange stuff, you know, linking Mars and Earth, you know. And of course, one of the most important things, which a guy named Mac Tonis, who wrote a book called After the Martian Apocalypse. Mac, unfortunately, died a few years ago, a very young age, but he wrote this book called After the Martian Apocalypse, and he actually made a very good point and asked a really important question that most people don't ask. And it's like, why does the face on Mars look like a human face? You know, why doesn't it look like a grey alien face or something like that, or a reptilian? And he wondered, you know, if it was deliberately built to demonstrate that there was a connection between Mars and Homo sapiens on planet Earth. You know, that it was meant as almost like a marker for us that when we develop spaceflight and we go to Mars, as we've now done, we would see evidence that somebody had left an image of our faces, if you like, that we would all recognize to see. You know, Max speculated that maybe that's why it was chosen to look like a face, so we would recognize it, you know, when we got there, and we would see evidence that somebody either got there before us, you know, or there was somebody there kind of like us at one point, you know, in its distant past. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, you know, that many of the Face on Mars research people, they don't think we're talking about a disaster that happened like 2,000-3,000 years ago. They're talking maybe 200,000, half a million years ago, you know, which would be plenty of time for much of the civilization and evidence to have been destroyed, you know. But I think it's these bigger structures that, you know, have obviously survived. So, you know, people ask me, what do you think? I actually do believe that, you know, there is evidence of some sort of, at one point at least, intelligent life on Mars. And I think a good argument could be made that there's still some sort of life on Mars. And I think a very strong argument could be made that there's a connection between these Cydonia structures and not only the Egyptian structures, but also, you know, some of the South American pyramids and their traditions and legends of the gods coming down, etc.
Well, Anastasia, what was that that news article you brought in about the hole on Mars?
Anastasia?
Hold on, I had to get my mute off. I'm sorry. I had to take my mute off. That was a picture that I sent you, and it was a crater that they photographed that is huge. It's enormous, and there appears to be a hole in it that goes way down deep below the surface. And it's very mysterious. They don't know what it is, and it's perfectly circular. Perfectly circular.
I don't think I saw that one.
And I'm sorry I don't have it with me at the moment, you know, to refer you to that, but we have it somewhere in our files. It was a photograph taken on Mars, and it was pretty recent. What's that been, Arielle? A couple weeks?
Right. We just within the last couple of weeks, and, I mean, yes, the hole is perfect. Is a perfect circle.
Perfect circle.
Yeah, it cannot have been made by,
It looks tooled. It looks positively tooled.
Uh-huh.
That's what a lot of people say about these structures. You know, they kind of look linear and symmetrical. They don't just look like, you know, one smooth side and then a ragged side. It looks like, you know, these are being created. And actually, on one of those pyramid pictures, Mac actually reproduced it in his After the Martian Apocalypse book. You can see what looks like a carved entrance point, you know, almost like an entrance to you would expect to see in a pyramid, you know, right at the foot of it. It looks really symmetrical.
Well, that's what this crater looks like as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there, as you look down through the center of it, even from the space shot, it looks as if there's something inside the blackness. So it's a great mystery. No one knows what it is. But I would like to ask if you know about those new discoveries of lost pyramids found in Egypt that's just been reported that I read about, that they thought they found two more pyramid complexes. This was taken by satellite, Google Earth satellite. And they're about 90 miles apart, and they think that there's a whole entire city under the sand with more pyramids, one of them larger than the Big Pyramid in Giza. Have you heard about that yet?
Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, this isn't as surprising as a lot of people assume it could be. You know, people say there's no way, you know, we could still be discovering ancient cities and things like this. But what a lot of people forget is what the ancients often did. You know, they were fighting battles with each other. So, you know, somebody would overtake another person's country. And, you know, if a city got razed to the ground in a war, you know, they would build in the same place. They'd, recreate. So you often find evidence of, you know, one particular city is based, you know, built on the foundations and the ruins of another one, you know, or there's another one close by where they sort of, you know, built close by it, you know, and over time the other one got relegated to where, you know, the ground changed and shifted, etc. And before you know it, you know, it's sort of 40 feet underground and nobody knows it's there. We actually get that a lot, and, you know, there are also examples in the oceans where there seem to be evidence of artificial structures, you know, just miles out at sea, which would be sort of, again, like a clear indication of possibly a shifting in the oceans, which might be relative to a flood. But, you know, I mean, it is one of these situations where certainly smaller discoveries, you know, are often made out in Egypt, you know, whether it's just, you know, finding, you know, archaeological digs and finding, you know, evidence of tools and that sort of thing. But, you know, we do find a lot of evidence of this where, you know, particularly pictures taken from Google Earth and aircraft, etc., you can actually make out, you know, the old foundations far better than you can when you're on the ground. You know, that's how, also in England, Google Earth has shown evidence of ancient stone circles in part of the English countryside that nobody knew about, but you can still vaguely see, like, the old circular outline. And when they've dug down, you know, they've found evidence of ancient man having lived there. So I think we're going to see more revelations on this, you know, because
technology.
This is the ideal way the technology provides an ideal way to see what's under the ground. So.
There has been, in this year alone, just a phenomenal amount of archaeological discoveries going on all over the planet. South America, they're uncovering things, parts of the United States, other areas of the world. They're uncovering ancient cultures at record rates that I've never seen before. So I don't know what all of that particularly is about, but they're announcing them one after the other, and a lot of secret history is coming, or maybe it's not secret. I mean, they're telling us about it, but who knows what will be uncovered as they dig up a lot of these sites, and hopefully that's really hoping that they will share that with us. They haven't necessarily done that in the past. But the point is that here we are at 2012, and we're certainly finding out a lot about hidden civilizations on the planet that have never been known before. And, you know, we got to accept that this is probably just the tip of the iceberg with the planet's history being much older than probably, you know, we've been told, and a lot of things that have never been known are now coming to light. It's a pretty exciting time if you're into that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't sort of realize how quickly, you know, a civilization can vanish. Now, you know, if something obliterated the human race overnight, you know, but not, you know, to where it's like a catastrophic massive disaster, it's like it was a disease that wiped, a virus wiped us all out, you know, our structures would take, would stand for years, you know, and even when they topple down, like, you know, 1,000 years down the line, well, the rocks and the formations, people would, if anybody visited the Earth, you know, they'd still be able to see they were clearly created or whatever. So, you know, the evidence would exist probably for tens and tens of thousand years in some format. But then, you know, if you have things like, you know, massive floods and the parts of the land or the world that were once land become, you know, the bottom of the ocean, and the bottom of the ocean then becomes the land and vice versa, then over time, you know, these civilizations and evidence would vanish. And particularly as I think, I'm not so sure personally in the past, you know, I'm not sure there was ever a worldwide civilization like ours. I think we would see more evidence of it. But I can sort of deal more with the idea, which is actually more upheld, you know, in the ancient stories, the idea that certain parts of the world flourished where civilizations grew massively and quickly and developed really astonishing technology, like the Middle East, South America, India, places like that. These seem to be the central areas where these stories of mighty civilizations and, you know, the gods coming down, it was all in these areas. You know, you never hear, like, pretty much about Russia or mainland Europe or Britain or, you know, or wherever, Australia or North America. It's all South America, the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think if there were massive civilizations there and they obliterated themselves, it would be, that would explain far more easily why we haven't found evidence, because they were more localized, you know, than just than worldwide.
Mm-hmm. You know, a couple weeks ago, we had James O'Conn as a guest, and he is an archaeoengineer with a passion for Mayan history and legends. And he went to this city that it starts with a Q. The pronunciation escapes me right now, but down on the border between Guatemala and Mexico, I think. Anyway, he being an engineer, a forensic engineer, where his job in modern day times he gets called in when a major building fails and there's a catastrophe, and then he has to come in and figure out what went wrong and why it fell, and so he's dealing with ruins on a modern day scale. He goes down to this area and discovered the ruins of a suspension bridge that was built by the Mayans, and that was just fascinating. Again, the technology that ancient civilizations acquired, achieved, or were shown, it just demonstrates over and over and over again, you know, in India, the texts of flying vehicles, they just always, we think at this point that we are the wisest, the smartest, the most advanced technologically. But I'm sure that every civilization thinks that at their peak, right? That we're the best that's ever been, and no one else has ever done this before.
Our civilization, you know, I mean, we there's more and more of us, you know. Resources are dropping, the weather's changing, you know, and the world's becoming a bit of a grim place, you know. Trends suggest, you know, 100 years from now, there's going to be a couple more billion people than there are now. And a couple, you know, after that, there'll be a couple more billion people. The planet and, you know, the resources just cannot keep sustaining people. And, you know, there's also the tipping point. A lot of people don't realize, this isn't spoken about much. You know, there's this sort of proud thing that, you know, the human race's lifespan is now at its highest, at its peak. You know, it's like 80, so I think it's like 81 for women and 79 for men or something like that. So, you know, but it's all now verging around the 80 mark or the low 80s, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, it was sort of the mid-70s or whatever. But what you don't hear a great deal about is that, you know, with the kids today sort of sitting in front of computers, not riding around town on the bikes, like, you know, because they're told not to, you know, they basically have fear instilled in them that, you know, you can't do this or whatever. And, you know, they just don't get off the computer. And, you know, food is becoming the main dominant source of entertainment. What's happening is you're having a rise of obesity where today's kids, you know, are developing sort of pre-diabetic conditions by the, you know, the age of 12 or 13. And what scientists are predicting is for the first time within the next sort of 20 years or so, when these people become adults, the lifespan will actually start to get lower. So, you know, things aren't looking so bright. And, you know, there's speculation that there's a tipping point for civilizations where they either survive or they collapse. And if they collapse, then the next one starts over, you know. So, or maybe it's our destiny where they always collapse. You know, that's why there's so many of these stories in the past. Perhaps it's the natural selective order of nature that, you know, when things get problematic, nature steps in and starts over again, you know.
Well, the nature of the universe is balance, and when things are out of balance long enough, nature has to bring things back into balance. And I think that this is related to, you know, the Mayan calendar. And, yeah, we are coming to the end of a cycle. We are ending the Piscean Age. We're starting the Aquarian Age. And the systems that propagated the problems, the non-sustainability and you know, using resources that are not refillable and all of that, those practices are what is going to be gone. Those are the practices that are going to collapse, the things that are not sustainable, the things that are not, you know, life-giving. And that's a very necessary thing, you know. It's like trimming the fat off the steak and let's just get rid of it because it's not working, it's not adding to our health and our growth. And certainly it is up to the parents to make sure that their children are not using cell phones, because there is so much evidence of the dangers of cell phones that, of course, the wireless industry is paying people to deny. But, yeah, I mean, kids using cell phones after about 10 years, by the time they're in college, they're going to have some serious health problems, and that is compounded, of course, by bad dietary habits and health habits and all that kind of thing. But I really think it's up to the parents, especially parents who are raising starseed children, to take responsibility for establishing better, you know, living habits. And I guess I'm kind of get up my soapbox here because I'm just really on about the parent responsibilities.
I agree. I mean, ironically, I'm not a parent, but I mean, I do understand, you know, I do know the value that, you know, I think that the scary thing is, what about when these kids today, when they become parents and they've known no difference, you know, that's the scary thing. It's kind of like you're almost on like a downward path then, because nobody's ever known a life any different, you know. It's you know, I mean, it's like I just don't see kids doing, I mean, all civilizations change and develop, etc., but I'm not sure it's developing when kids don't play out in the streets anymore, you know, and run around and fall over and cut themselves. And, you know, today it's like you'd have health and safety round, or, you know, somebody would be sent round from the police to see if the families are abusing the kids because the kid's got a busted arm. Well, you know, a bruise on their arm. I used to jump out of trees and go to school with cuts and bruises all over the place. No teacher ever came round, somebody from the school, and grilled my mom and dad about what's happened to your son. It was, that's what you do when you're a kid. You fall off your bike, and that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to have fun and enjoy yourself, not worry that the men in black are going to come around and take you away.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, I totally agree with you. And
Arielle, I think we're running out of time. Do we have anybody that needs to call in?
I think that we have covered so much information so well that we have answered all the questions. So
that's good.
So So tonight we are just enjoying the information and the work of Nick Redfern. And Nick, are your books besides they are available on your blog page that I said before?
Yeah, all the books are available and listed at the they're all listed at the blog, but people can buy them through Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, or in Barnes & Noble shops, or pretty much any good book-selling outlets. And I think other than my first couple of books, they're all still in print, and even those are still available, in used format or whatever, so.
I looked at your blog page, Nick, and it's just really amazing how many books you have written. And I want to compliment you on your incredible memory, because you really keep track of all these details and obviously have a mind that can absorb a lot and get a lot of data and then share it so fluently with us. And you're welcome, and it's been a really interesting program. And I especially want to thank you for being our guest tonight. It was very, very interesting.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. I had a good time.
Well, it's our pleasure. And when your new book comes out, we do want you to come back. So let us know when it's about to come out. And
I will do.
We'll have you back, because I want everyone to go check out, with so many books on so many subjects. You really have something for everyone. And once again, that is the website is Nick, N-I-C-K, Redfern, R-E-D-F-E-R-N. And the rest of it is fortean.blogspot.com, Fortean, Nick Redfern Fortean, Fortean, .blogspot.com. There you go, got it up. And you can find all of his books at any major book outlet. And Nick, thank you again so much for joining us this evening. And we really know when we have a great guest, because the time just flies by. And I do appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thank you.
You are so welcome, everyone. This has been Nick Redfern on Starseed Radio Academy. We will be back next week, same time. And we look forward to your letters and photos of orbs to Anastasia. I'd like to thank everyone on behalf of Starseed Radio Academy for listening. And I'll say good night now. So thank you so much again, Nick. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.